This is Patrick Wannis, human behavior and relationship expert, PhD. Is there a difference between men and women? Of course we know the answer to that question, and it's a big yes. But what are the differences and what creates those differences? Well, according to one expert, it's the difference in the physiology, but specifically the difference in our brain that affects the way we relate to each other. Robert Holmes is an expert in the science of human behavior and performance enhancement. He has a passion for neurology, leadership, and psychology. Interestingly, his clients include high-performance execs and CEOs, business owners, athletes, and people from a variety of walks of life. Robert is a professionally certified coach, known as PCC. He has over 20 years of business experience, including executive and business consulting and management mentoring. But even more impressively, the Australian Army ceased their leadership coaching program and hired Robert Holmes and his company to work with the Australian Army to coach wounded, ill, and injured soldiers returning from service. As I mentioned at the outset, one of Robert's expertise is the differences in the way men and women relate to each other due to the differences in the human brain. Recently, Robert led a marriage retreat and talked about, or specifically trained the attendees and participants about the impact of the human brain in relationships. Robert Holmes.
G'day, Patrick.
Yes, hello, and how did you get interested? I should say, of course, that you're a fellow Aussie, but let's not hold that against you. How did you get interested in the differences between the brain of men and women?
I do a lot of relationship coaching, and usually, say, when a high-performing individual comes in, we get talking about their business, and pretty quickly, their children or their spouse turns up in the conversation, and that's what began, you know, led me into. Obviously, I'm also curious about my own spouse, and we've been married 20 years, and I desperately want to understand her better.
Hold on. You said, I'm curious about my spouse, and we've been married for 20 years. Are you making the male admission that you couldn't understand your spouse?
Absolutely.
You understand her better now?
Okay. I understand her better, yeah.
All right. So when you began to study the differences, the real question that everyone has on their mind is, how do we even know that there are differences? We say that there are differences. Obviously, men will say, oh, I don't understand the woman. And then we'll say, I don't understand the man. Now, there has been, in California, and I think it might be from UCLA, one neuroscientist who said, there is no difference between the male and female brain when we are born. Which then begs the question, does the human brain develop, the male brain and the female brain, do they develop in different parts based on environment, based on hormonal changes, based on culture, based on programming? What do you know about that aspect?
That's absolutely true. So the human fetus is identical in every respect for the first 8 weeks of gestation. But in the eighth week, that fetus is then bathed in either estrogen or testosterone, and that bathing goes on all the way through to the end of the 40th week, and then the testes, or you know, once they're born, that young boy or young girl continues to bathe their brain in either male or female hormones. So we then rely on people who've done the research. So Dr. Anne Moyer or Dr. Luanne Brizendine have both spent, you know, 30 plus years researching the differences between men and women's brains, and they've published their results extensively. So after the eighth week, no doubt that the two brains are different.
All right, so Robert, what light can you shed on the myth, if it is a myth, that says that women are primarily right-brained, they're primarily creative, and men are primarily left-brained? That means that they're associated with cause and effect, with logic and reasoning. Is there any truth to that statement?
Yeah, that's a great question, Patrick. And you're right, it is a myth. It's a misunderstanding of the way the two brains are made up. So as far as we know, men's brains and women's brains, left and right preferences are not gender specific. If you were able to take the top off a man's head and off a woman's head, you would find 90% similarity, because we are, after all, the same species. And you'll find about 10% differences. And the differences between the hemispheres, say, for example, with language, men process language only in one hemisphere, women process it in two. When it comes to the ability to see or be attracted to the other sex, a man's area of sexual stimulation is 2.5 times larger than a woman's, and he will notice curvature more quickly than she will. So there are some fundamental, you know, underlying differences in the brain, but they're not left brain, right brain specific.
Okay. So during your recent 3-day retreat, you were teaching that there are 6 primary and possibly critical differences between men and women based on urology. What are those 6 differences?
Great question. So just leading into that, I pointed out to men and women that, you know, at the most fundamental level, our chromosomes are different. You know, we've got XX and XY. So every cell in the two bodies is different. That may not sound like it's important, but for a woman, because she has XX, she has twice the number of rods and cones in her eye, which means she sees, you know, to the power of 10 number of colours than he does. So a man cannot see. You know, have you ever been a part of an argument where a man says, that's orange, and the woman says, no, it's not, it's mandarin? Or, you know, that's pink, and she says, no, it's not, it's, you know, red? Because men can't see the colours that women can. There's a very basic difference. Women's skin is 10 times more sensitive than a man's skin. So we have these fundamental differences, and then taking them sort of on from there, we walk through at least 6 profound differences between our two.
Before you get to those 6 differences, you raised some interesting points. You talked about women having much greater visual powers as it pertains to colour differentiation.
Definitely.
And then you talked about the sensitivity of skin.
Yep.
But all of women's senses are much more acute and much more heightened than men's, including hearing, correct?
Correct, yes.
And if women have greater visual powers than men, why are they not as visually inclined as men are? Because men are stimulated through vision, whereas women tend to be stimulated more by what they hear, correct?
Yeah, perfect. Because the way the rods and cones are structured in the eye allow women peripheral vision, and in their occipital lobe, in the back of their brain where the eye parts of their brain are putting together the information, in a woman's brain, those are directly connected to relationships. So the parts of their brain that are trying to make sense of the environment to find out, where do I fit in? Who do I know here? What's going on? Whereas a man's eye is structured to see targeted information. So what's right in front of me? You know, if you imagine us growing up on the savannah, where's the kangaroo? Where, you know, what am I hunting? Where can I find? So he walks into a room, and the bits that control the information coming into his brain are not loaded to information related to relationships at all. It's doing a match against objects. So it's saying, do I recognize this? Is that a spear? Is that a cheetah? Oh, that girl over there, I know her. Wow, she's pretty. So his brain isn't even processing the visual information the same way. And all of that's interesting, except it's highly damaging to relationships if you don't understand that about your mate. So she walks into a room and she's looking for connection. He walks into a room and he's wondering, you know, am I safe? Is there, you know, anything to mate with in here? His brain isn't even processing the scene in the room the same as you.
But you said that she's walking in the room and thinking about connection. Explain that.
Well, because the visual information and the auditory information flowing in is connecting to her memory of and her feelings about relationship. I ran this experiment because I was met with some, doubt and skepticism when I shared this at the marriage retreat.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why would that be?
I don't know.
Okay, go on.
So on the first night, I had the room arranged in one particular way, and then the next morning I came in before everyone else and I moved the furniture and I set up some objects in the room that looked like they might be a threat. And then I ran I had a camera in the back left-hand corner of the room, and I just let them into the room one at a time. So the first woman in the room looks around and finds a nice place to sit, doesn't notice that the furniture's been moved. The first man in the room walks in, stops, looks around at the room, notices a couple of the objects have moved, and says to me, "Who moved the furniture?" I said, "Oh, I did. Just find a seat." So he sits as far away from the woman as he can. And that happened with every single person that walked in the room. All the females looked around.
You said that you placed things, objects in the room that were a threat. What do you mean by that?
Well, so I brought a long stick that looked like a spear into the room, and I placed it in the back left-hand corner near the firewood, just to see whether or not he'd noticed that there was anything of threat in the room. Now, the men that walked in the room didn't necessarily notice that there was a spear-like object in the room, but they stopped and scanned their environment for threat. They stopped and scanned the environment and said, "All the furniture's moved," instead of, "Oh, Mary's here. How was breakfast, Mary?" The women did not do that. I didn't have a single woman stop and say, "Who moved the furniture?" They walked in and said, "Oh, I was sitting over there last night, and now Mary's sitting there. Hey, can I sit with you?" And so the girls all came in the room and started relating to one another and chatting and picking up the books and reading through the information and talking to me. Nearly every man, so I would say 95% of the men, stopped as they came in the room, scanned the environment, and said, "Who moved the furniture?" It was just hilarious.
So the men, when they entered the room, the men were more sensitive to their environment. The women were more sensitive to the people within the environment.
Correct. And that has implications. If you roll that into a relationship, what's he noticing and what's she noticing in the relationship, in the bedroom, in the living room, as they come home and the kids come home from school? What are the things that her brain is automatically running to and she thinks he should be noticing, but he doesn't? And vice versa.
Give me an example.
Well, a classic example happened after the marriage retreat. Husband usually parks his car in one place and wife usually parks her car in another place. To her, it usually doesn't matter. I mean, whoever's home first parks in whatever space. She hasn't really noticed. He gets home and he notices, A, she's in his spot, and B, there are little spots of oil on the ground under where her car used to be, and now he has to park his car there. And he says to her, "Honey, have you noticed that your car's leaking oil?" And she says, "What? Take a guess."
She says, "Of course, no, I didn't."
That's right. Oil? What do you mean? And he says, so he goes to her car, he turns it on, he notices the red light on the dash, and he says, "Honey, there's a red light on the dash. Don't you understand that means you need to put oil?" I didn't see it," she says. And she's not lying. She's not playing dumb. That stuff doesn't matter. Now, again, you know, please allow a caveat. This is a gross generalization. We're talking about in the norm this happens. But of course, there are some women who make it to the top of the medical profession, the top of maths and science, who end up flying aircraft. Of course, they notice stuff like that. But I'm sort of talking about in general and in the norm. Most ladies are not going to notice that they swap car spots, and they're not going to notice the dots of oil on the ground, to his great frustration.
Right. From another point of view, though, it can easily be argued to say, well, the reason that men pay more attention to this than women do is that the woman isn't paying attention to the car, the oil, the light, because she thinks that her man will, her husband will, her partner will take care of those things. The same way that the man says, "I don't care too much about the kitchen," or this, without me being misogynistic, that the man says, "Well, that's the woman's domain, and my partner has chosen that to be her domain, so I don't give that so much attention." Is that the explanation, or is it purely neurological?
It's both, of course. So, you know, we talk about the bath that the fetus is given in the eighth week. That's about 50% of the story. And then when the child is born, they come out into a culture and the culture begins to groom them and teach them about social norms. If you want to strip it right back, there's some great studies done at Stanford with children who were 3 and 4 years old, and they were given a wide range of toys to play with, and they found that the boys tended to play fighting games and the girls tended to play interactive kind of you be the mummy and I'll be the daddy, you be the doctor and I'll be the nurse games. And the boys were kind of forced to go and play the girls' games, and they lasted about one round, and then they quit, and they went back over and started playing war games again.
Yeah, another similar study, they found that the boys will tend to compete with each other, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Specifically about who's going to be the alpha male, or the alpha boy in this case.
And this, again, this is neurology. So the man's brain and his eyes walk into a room and automatically prioritize the room according to hierarchy. So they want to know who the alpha male is and what their relationship to that alpha male is. Most of the time, a woman won't notice that. She will look for who she belongs to and how they're doing and then go and relate to that person. And so this has been proven in childhood through threes and fours, through teenage years and right on through. Again, there are alpha females, and alpha females are honed into who's in charge and whether and what's their relationship to the alpha male. So that does happen a bit, but hierarchy really, really matters to a man's brain.
Okay. Is this example you just gave us one of the six key differences between the male brain and the female brain?
Yeah, so that's visual perception. And one of the ways this plays out in a relationship is that there's this brain chemical that primes our brains to react to visual information. And in a man's brain, that chemical causes him to read boredom in the face of someone else as anger and hostility, and he's going to respond to someone who's bored. So say I'm lecturing in a classroom and I'm looking around the room and I see a few students who are bored, I will perceive as a man, I will perceive that as them being quite angry and hostile to my points. That same set of chemistry in a female brain perceives boredom as interest, care, and sometimes passiveness. So you see that information coming in, and if you think of a woman and a man talking to each other and he's getting bored, she's going to naturally say either, oh, he's listening, or he cares. And if she does that to him, he will automatically assume she's angry at him and hostile to his point. And this has implications for the way we communicate with each other.
But that seems strange, because that almost sounds counterintuitive. I thought it'd be the woman who would actually be more intuitive and would say, he's bored, therefore he's not being attentive and he's not interested and he doesn't care.
Well, she can see that he's bored, but she thinks that he still cares.
Okay.
And he kind of doesn't know whether she's bored or not, and pretty much thinks she's upset with me. I mean, how many times have you been in a situation, we have 7 kids in our home, and for one reason or another, my wife is often ticked off at one or other of them, and I'm home before she is, I've tended to their homework and reading and whatever else they need to do. She walks in and she gets ticked off at one of them, and I think she's angry with me, just automatically, and I have to hunt her down and say, are you upset with me? What's going on? No, it's, you know, one of the kids. Oh, okay, and that puts me at ease. And that still catches me out. Even though I know that's how it is, I still go and check out with her, are you angry with me? You seem ticked off.
Okay, so what about mirror neurons? Because mirror neurons, a recent discovery, is
yep.
our ability to look at someone else and know what they're feeling. And that means to know if the person has a sad face, an angry face, a disgusted face, because it's our way of determining is this person safe or not. So
Brilliant.
Wouldn't mirror neurons in this situation tell me she's happy at me or she's angry at me, or does it just say she's bored and I think she's bored with me and I think she's angry at me?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised mirror neurons. I wasn't sure how far to take this point, but mirror neurons are the mechanics behind what helps us show empathy and sympathy toward one another, her circuitry will tend toward causing her to show sympathy, which is saying, I've felt what you've felt. I'm like you are. Yes, we're the same. He's likely to switch to empathy, which is, yeah, I understand you feel that way. I don't. But I can understand that that's how you would feel. He will then express his result as slightly more standoffish. You know, I can see that you're hurt, rather than, yes, I've been hurt too. And she will tend to be very sympathetic and come across to whoever it is that's communicating as really understanding. The mirror neurons enable us also to map and marry and perform the same thing. So if she smiles, he smiles. If she crosses her leg, he crosses her leg. Salespeople have picked this up and kind of used it in a salesy kind of a way. Those mirror neurons don't switch on the same things inside our brain. So in a man, it switches on a thing called the temporal parietal junction, the TPJ, which gets him starting to think about how to solve the problem. In a woman, those mirror neurons switch on a thing called the MNS, and that switches on her emoting brain and her remain connected to this person part of her brain. So the mirror neurons don't even kick off the same circuitry.
Which explains why the woman comes home and proceeds to reveal that she's had a bad day, or someone's hurt her, someone's offended her, something's wrong.
Yep.
And the man sees that, and his instant, automatic, almost instinctual response is, I want to solve this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas what she's looking for is empathy. So is it safe and accurate to conclude that women are more empathetic than men?
Men can learn it, and I've spent an awfully long time learning and practicing empathy. You know, if you think of the show Lie to Me, where Cal Lightman is this scientist who, you know, learns how to read emotional signals, there are schools and schools where you can learn body language and facial recognition and, you know, empathy, which is great for a coach because that's part of rapport building. That's part of learning how to get in someone else's space and say, you can trust me, I understand. You know, doctors need this, nurses, all sorts of people. One of the other things I was going to say, though, is this TPJ in a man actually switches off his facial muscles. So as soon as he goes into problem-solving mode, he looks even less interested. Boy, oh boy, that's been the start of more than one argument. And for her, it switches on her facial muscles, and she starts magnifying and mirroring what she sees, which makes her appear highly engaged. You know, as long as we understand that about one another, we can say, so what I say to my eldest daughters is, do you want to have a man's conversation or a woman's conversation? So they start pouring out their heart after a long day at school, and they start going on, and my mind goes to solving their problem, and I just say, sweetheart, just stop for a minute. Is this a boy's conversation or a girl's conversation? And they're used to that now with me. And so they say, oh, Daddy, no, this can be a boy's conversation. Help me fix this.
Right. Now, of course, the average person listening to this interview and conversation right now isn't going to ask that. They're going to the more ideal way for them to ask it is, would you like me to help solve this, or do you want me just to listen?
Right. Perfect. Yeah, that's okay. Fair. And that is a relationship saver, really, when it comes down to stopping arguments. If we can just stop and do that, then we're going to really help understand one another a lot better.
Now, for the man, it helps him extraordinarily just to recognize, my natural response is, I want to solve this, I want to fix this. So yeah. If he can say to the lady in front of him, my natural response is, I want to solve and fix this, but what do you really want and need from me in this moment?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. Great relationship coaching right there.
Your information is truly enlightening. What are the other key differences between the male brain and the female brain?
Okay, well, let's talk about language and verbiage, the number of words we use. So remember the chromosomes are different. So men have XY chromosomes in all the cells in their body, and they don't have an area in their brains that can that is specifically dedicated to speaking. So, sorry men, but speaking is actually hard work for men. Constructing sentences, listening carefully, especially...
Are you saying I'm a dummy?
No.
It's but feel free to say it anyway.
Our circuits are designed to go hunt things down and kill them and bring them home so we can eat. So we're really great at physical stuff, but we have to work at communicating. So, you know, for women, if you're trying to get his attention, point to the thing you want him to think about. So if it's a recipe, grab his attention with your eye and point down to the recipe and say, honey, can we talk about a meal plan? Or, you know, direct your attention. So often I say to women, you know how he's sitting at the desk working on a computer and you call out to him and say, you know, what would you like for dinner? I was thinking of cooking a casserole, and he grunts. He didn't actually hear you. And then you say, are you okay if we go out, you know, after 7 and go play squash? And he grunts again. He still didn't hear you. He is completely focused on whatever's on the screen in front of him. Walk over and touch him on the shoulder. Get him to look at you. Now he can hear you. And communicating. Whereas the XX chromosomes in a woman's body, they create all sorts of places in the left and right hemisphere in your head that help you construct sentences and put things together. Think about a personal assistant's job or secretary's job or executive assistant's job. 90% of those tasks are staffed by women. Why is that? It's not a sexist employment thing. It's because that position requires an incredible ability to listen and communicate effectively. And women are great at that. So...
All right,
you know,
let's look at that. So, number one, you're saying that men give their attention to what they're looking at.
Correct.
So if you want to get their attention, either you put yourself in front of them or
yes.
you touch them so that they turn around and look at you and say, what do you want?
That's right.
All right.
And he's just going to grunt or say, uh-huh, and you can come out of that conversation convinced that he heard what you said. But my bet is he didn't.
Okay. You also said that men aren't great communicators, which then makes me completely puzzled about what about all of the great poets and orators that we've had over history. If we talk
poets?
About Plato, yeah, the poets, the orators, Plato,
yes.
Socrates, etc. Shelley.
Writing. Yeah, I agree with you. Writing is a different function to speaking. So... For a man, he can sit down and he can spend a long time writing a beautiful poem. He can write a book. He can construct sentences because he's got all the time in the world. Orators, almost invariably good orators, have spent 30 to 40 hours. Really amazing orators have put a lot of time into a 40-minute lecture. The best. So if you look at Steve Jobs, if you look at the people who've communicated at the peak of their game, the TED Talkers, right? TED.com. They've got 18 minutes. Now, I read a piece of research the other day that said the average preparation time for an 18-minute TED Talk is 18 hours. Okay? So
An hour a minute.
These people are putting a lot of prep time into what comes off as a very polished oration.
So really, we have more women presenting.
Well, and women probably don't need to do that much preparation. They may need, you know, some coaching on what images to pick or, you know, how to reach the male half of the audience or whatever, but they tend to speak off the cuff more naturally. Whereas a man can argue pretty effectively on his feet when he moves into being defensive, when he's into fight mode.
But that's why women are better at actually meeting people. Look, with all of my expertise in human behavior relationships, it still stuns me that I can introduce two women and suddenly they can be talking for hours.
Yeah.
Now, I'll introduce two men and they'll exchange a couple of sentences. And if it happens that they talk about a particular passion, such as a footy team or some other sporting event, they can talk for a long time, but otherwise they're struggling to know what to say to each other, and that's why men are just pretty cool hanging out with each other, having a beer, and they don't say anything But you introduce two women. I think, how is it that these two women can communicate for so long and they've just met?
Yeah, absolutely. And so here we run into one of the differences between men's brains and women's brains is the women have this incredible interconnected, you know, network of neurons that connect all manner of disparate parts of their brain, whereas men's brains tend to be constructed in a way that is very subject specific. And so you want to talk footy, we can talk footy for hours, but if you're into fishing and I'm not, my fishing box is empty and yours is full. We got nothing to talk about. You know, so we tend to construct and categorize information in a very kind of box by box kind of arrangement. And people are just starting to get into doing more research into why that is. So that's what I've just shared with you, is kind of at the frontier of neuroscience, and we don't have a lot of understanding as to why that's true.
So is it then true that women use more words than men?
Absolutely. So we intuitively know this, but there have been a number of studies, one done in Italy, another in Spain, a number across the UK and the US, that have shown, you know, pretty much across most cultures now, the male brain keeps a database of about 35,000 words that he uses, and he uses 2,000 to 3,000 words a day, and once they're used, that's it. Women have, on average, a database of about 50,000 words, and they employ between 5,500 to 8,500 words a day, plus nonverbal body language. And
all right,
the top,
let
the
me
top
understand
of the list.
This. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but this is really important for me to understand. You're saying that women have a larger database of words, number one.
Yep.
You also said that once men use X amount of words, that's it, they're done. What does that mean?
Well, he doesn't feel like communicating anymore. So there's no motivation inside him. Once he's worked all day, and by the way, written words don't count for this number, so these are spoken words, he loses the motivation to continue to communicate. So he just wants to get home and watch the telly. He wants to get home and answer his email. He doesn't feel motivated to keep finding words, whereas a woman will, she has a much higher threshold. She has a lot more words to use. And she's going to plomp herself down in bed at night. She's still got maybe 3,000 words left to use for the day. She's highly motivated to use them. And this is the cause of, you know, quite a lot of arguments that happen at the end of the day.
Because she wants to keep talking, he doesn't. But when you say the women have a larger database, do you mean that she uses 3,000, 4,000 different words, or just total amount of words?
Total amount of words. So she keeps a bigger dictionary, if you like, in her head. She has, just like they, women can see more colours and they can see, you know, more tastes and they can feel more sensitivity, they have more words for stuff. So I didn't even know what chartreuse was, but that's a word I've heard a number of women use to describe a colour. Well, that's a word she has in her head that I don't have. I've got blue and green and aqua and teal, maybe teal. So they've gone and got more words for their experience of life. So they have a bigger dictionary, if you like. And
so they
do
have a wider amount of words and a higher amount of total words.
Correct. So 5,500 to 8,500 words a day before she feels unmotivated to keep communicating. So if you think about a person who, say, the male is a mechanic and doesn't talk much during the day, and he comes home with 3,000 left in his bank, and she's a communicator for a living, and she's used 8,000 words in the day, what you're going to find in that household is that she doesn't feel like talking over dinner, and he does. And he wants to talk about work, and she doesn't know the first thing about his work. So we point that out to them in relationship therapy or in relationship counselling. Yeah.
Huge communication gap and talent. So if you are a man that's speaking a lot during the day and your wife isn't, then you should send one of your female friends over to hang out with your wife for a couple of hours so that she expends more of the words, and by the time you get home, you only have to talk about 1,000 words and everyone's happy.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And by the way, one of the rescue packages for a relationship like that is take the dog for a walk in the morning and have your conversation first thing. You know, communicate with each other in the morning.
Great suggestion. So expand your words with her so that she's happy rather than spending it with some bozo at work who really doesn't care either way, and you're going to talk about nothing.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's summarize the key differences you've raised thus far.
So
I'm asking you to do that.
Sure, sure. So in utero, men and women are the same up till the eighth week. About 50% of the changes take place because of the bath that brain receives, and about 50% because of social conditioning. So culture, as they grow up, they learn what roles they're supposed to play. Women are much more sensitive. Touch, hearing, senses are much more amped up than men. And then if we think about linguistics, men don't have a place in their brain specifically designed for speech. Women do. So you want to communicate with him, get his attention, get him to look at you and communicate with him directly. He is much more targeted in his vision. She is much more widely scoped in her vision. She has a bigger database, a bigger dictionary in her head, and uses more words, and he has less. His brain is kind of pre-programmed sexually. He has got a place in his head that's 2.5 times bigger than yours for a woman that notices, the size of breasts, the shape of hips, the attractiveness of women, and theirs is much smaller. When you're communicating, his mirror neurons switch to solving the problem and her mirror neurons switch to staying connected. When he is bored, he looks to a woman, he looks still interested and listening, a bit passive. When she looks disinterested, he thinks that's aggression. And social symmetry. So he walks into a room and looks for hierarchy. She walks into a room and looks for connection. I think
That's a superb story. That's an excellent summary. So how many differences are we left with between the male brain and the female brain?
Well, going through the research, I found 30. But on the marriage weekend, I only taught 6. And the last one is that I wanted to share, at least in this conversation, was just fear. So a man registers fear very strongly in two parts of his brain, and he goes to fight, flight, or freeze, and it's a very physical experience for him, and it happens very quickly. So if you've read some of the recent literature, people are talking about upstairs brain, downstairs brain, or I've even heard croc brain and human brain. His croc brain is on fight, flight, or freeze.
Croc meaning crocodile.
Crocodile brain, his brain stem, the lower order biological part of his brain.
Which we used to refer to as the lizard, the reptilian brain.
Yeah, absolutely. The lizard brain, the monkey brain, and the human brain. So his lizard brain is programmed to respond very quickly to fear threat, to threat to the system. Her brain registers fear much more like anxiety, confusion, kind of a blurring of her cognitive decision making, and it's not even connected to her lizard brain. So when there's a threat, that response connects with her higher brain. That response connects with his lower brain. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so in a bedroom, the husband and wife are lying asleep. There's a sound downstairs, the traditional setup. There's a sound downstairs. How does each one respond based on neurological differences?
She's going to hear it and kind of wake up and wonder what that is and begin to think about what it could be. Is it the tree? Is it the cat? Is it, what's moving down there? He will leap out of bed. So he'll hear it and he will reach for the baseball bat or the gun or the whatever the response system is, and he'll be to the door before she's even figured out what it is. So this happens in car accidents. This happens walking down the street when maybe somebody's trying to steal your handbag. There are lots of examples.
Robert, what do you mean this happens in car accidents? Explain that, please.
Well, in a car accident, the male brain switches to croc brain instantly, and croc brain knows how to drive a car badly. So croc brain is going to grab the steering wheel and react physiologically, instinctively. So men who've been in car accidents have this experience of someone else taking over the driving. So life slows down for them, time slows down, and they have a feeling of what is going on here, and they're looking and things are moving very, very slowly, and then suddenly they're put back in control. Their heart beats very quickly, they look around, they're palpitating, they start worrying, and then they pull the car over or it's smashed. For a woman, she experiences the car accident completely differently to that. So she goes through the car accident and she's still in control of the vehicle, and depending on the level of skill, she'll either make good decisions or bad. And the whole time she's able to describe what she's seeing, what happened to the other car, where things were. And so when you look at insurance claims written by men and women, that they're so different. And insurance agencies know this, so they're often looking for, bystanders of both sexes to try and explain what happened. So she's going to be shocked. She's going to be shocked.
When you say, sorry to cut you off. When you say a car accident, you mean whilst the car accident is occurring, there is a different neurological response from the man and the woman.
Absolutely.
And you're saying it slows down for the man?
Time slows down for the man because his brain has been hijacked by the lizard brain. So lizard brain has taken over the driving, and your brain runs at 80 frames per second. So you can't see the frame rate, but your brain is taking a picture 80 times a second. If croc brain hijacks your upper capacities, that slows down to about 1/24th or 24 frames a second, and you experience time slowing down, cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha, like that. Women can experience that when they're deeply under threat. So you often see in crime cases, women describing that experience of time slowing down in rape cases or in cases where they've been attacked in a park. So their brain does have that experience as well, but for different reasons and under different circumstances. So the time slowing down is a sure sign that croc brain is taking over.
Right. And yet for the woman, she doesn't engage her crocodile or reptilian brain as fast as a man does.
Well, it doesn't engage it at all, probably, because she can stay conscious and cognitive. You've run into these PTSD cases where a man kind of checks out. He's been home from the war. He hears a noise downstairs and he kind of checks out and he responds to the threat as though it were a war situation. You've read those in the newspaper?
Of course.
Yeah, so part of the explanation, not a complete explanation, but part of the reason that happens is the lower order functions for him have taken over. And he literally is being driven by a different part of his brain.
So how do you help sufferers and victims of post-traumatic stress disorder? Specifically when you're saying that in this situation you understand that what's happening isn't just from a psychological perspective, because in psychology we're saying he's repeating the incident again in his mind. It's repeating again and again. And so many therapists will try to, even in cognitive behavioral therapy or in hypnotherapy, they'll try to stop him from repeating that, or they'll try to change that image or remove the emotion.
Yes.
How do you, from a neurological perspective, help victims of PTSD?
Wow, that's a whole nother one-hour conversation, unfortunately. But, the roughly, PTSD or anxiety, depression, many of these other things are experienced by soldiers as a uploading of emotional trauma because of some external thing that's going on, something they see, something they hear triggers.
External trigger.
Yeah, there's a trigger. And what they're doing is uploading history. So there's a past experience that's being uploaded and it's being processed through a piece of the brain. So, without going into the structures, there's amygdala and hippocampus and other bits and pieces in the limbic system. He's loading that memory into the wrong part of his brain, which causes him to experience it as a present experience instead of a memory.
Past, right.
Yeah, so the past is being loaded up, but it's being loaded into a current present experience, and so he's being re-traumatized. So I had an experience of having a skydiving accident and smashing my leg to pieces, and I was traumatized by that event for 3 full months before those memories learned to go to where they should have been processed in the memory part of the brain instead of the current experience part. So there's lots of ways of treating PTSD and trauma. As a coach, we don't get across into the medical or the psychological area. So if they're doing EMDR, rapid eye movement desensitization, or they're doing hypnotherapy and so forth, we leave that to those professionals. What we do is we try and get the soldier to... The first thing is we find out what their time preference is. So all of us are born with and grow up either preferring a future, a present, or a past frame of reference. And depending on what their preferred frame of reference is, we can then drill down and say, okay, what are the memories and where are you experiencing them now? What is a better strategy? You've surely heard of the term neuroplasticity.
Of course, so because the brain has the ability to keep changing and developing and adapting.
Perfect. So we can then work with the soldier to reprogram the way his brain fires that memory and work on his time preference. The key for a coach is we want the person to live in today and think about tomorrow. A psychologist or a counsellor is going to be working on the past and bringing them into the present and giving them strategies for survival. So we're kind of starting with now and moving them forward. Does that make sense?
Right, that's true. Because that's what with my clients, I'm helping them to clear out the past, to release emotion, to dissolve, eliminate, transform a belief.
Yep.
So that now they're almost like a clean slate, so they can operate in the present moment and then thus create a future.
Perfect.
So, yes, that makes sense. The reason I ask you about PTSD is because you also, in differentiating the male brain from the female brain, are you saying that women have a different experience with PTSD than men?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that women experience fear differently, and fear is one of the main components in the way a person became traumatized. So the physiology, the underlying brain reaction to fear is fundamentally different, but ultimately what's produced at the end of all that is a trauma, and trauma is experienced pretty much the same way by men and women. Different things can cause it, so it's very unlikely. Male rape is, you know, very, very rare. Women are very likely to have been traumatized by that. The armed forces still are largely made up of men, and so active duty in, you know, fire brigades or ambulance or military forces are largely going to be men struggling with that. But once it's come down to a medical diagnosis of PTSD, men and women are suffering the same thing. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
So here is a question that will hopefully help a lot of women and then a lot of men.
Yeah.
Why is it, if there is a neurological answer to this, why is it that men tend to withhold their emotions and women tend to expose their emotions?
Awesome. Well, perhaps I can answer that using fear as an example. So fear is an emotion. It's an afferent emotion. It's something we experience when we're expressing it. A man's use of fear or reaction to fear will be to remove the threat by using confrontation. So he will respond to it, not emotionally. So he's experiencing the emotion, but his reaction will be to remove the threat. Yeah? A woman will experience the threat, her higher brain will understand it, but she will become flooded with that emotion and her experience of it, and may then become overwhelmed, hysterical, distracted, because that all the chemistry is kind of flooding around in her brain, and she will emote. She will vent. She will get rid of that. And it's true for anger. It's true for fear. It's true for those primal kind of what you would think of as negative emotions. She will tend to express them. He will tend to use that to respond, to go do something. So if you think about us growing up on the savannah again, we experience fear and we will go kill the tiger, you know. And again,
or we
that's
use the fear to kill the tiger.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. We use it to motivate us to go do something. The sad thing in relationships, though, is what if your partner is the perceived threat? So she's emoting and reacting, and he will treat her like a threat response. So he will attack her.
Why does he perceive her as a threat?
Because of the way his brain is experiencing fear. He's switching down to croc brain, and he will say, I have got to stop this. I've got to terminate this. I've got to deal with this, just like a tiger. So he's viewing her as a threat response, drops down, loses it, and becomes what? Becomes physical. 96% of domestic violence cases are men attacking women, a very, very high order, because he switched down to croc brain. Now, that doesn't excuse him for a minute, because if he just stopped and breathed and concentrated and looked at her and realized she was a human being, he would never treat her that way.
Right.
So
it explains it. It doesn't justify it. Now, one of the ways that
correct.
I teach clients, so this is, it's just a simple philosophy. I say, let the woman have her storm.
Yeah, good advice.
And that means you're not the cause of the storm, even if she says you are. You don't have to put yourself in the storm. Just let her have her storm, and there'll be a calm after the storm. The
yes.
problem is, as you've very well explained, is that there's two things going on. One is, depending on what emotion she's expressing, we want to solve it. We want to stop her having emotion. We see her crying and we don't know how to respond to it. We want to stop her. If she's getting angry, she's frustrated, or she's raising her voice, or she's expressing some intense emotion, we might want to calm her down because we think it's a threat to her. And
yes.
then the second way you explained it very well is when she's becoming extremely emotional, that means expressing intense emotion, raising a voice, screaming, hollering, flailing with her arms, we unfortunately process that as a threat to our own survival. And then we react.
Absolutely. And I love the way you've explained that. That's true. And keep in mind, too, she has a croc brain as well. So the more worked up she gets, the more she's switching down gears and moving into croc brain, the best thing the man can do, stop trying to solve the problem right there and then. Let her have space. Let the storm pass. Take a deep breath. Take 10 minutes out. Go have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. Walk the dog. Come back to your conversation when you've both calmed down.
All right. So let me ask you this. You told me that you've got 7 children in your house.
Yeah.
This is the same thing that happens with a child that's throwing a tantrum, whether the child's 2, 4, or 5. Once the child enters that phase, that stage of throwing a tantrum, there's very little that anyone can do to stop the child, and unfortunately a parent will become so frustrated, they might try and smack the child or they might try and shout at the child, and
yeah.
that doesn't seem to work. Are you saying that the better response is to stand back and, if it's appropriate in the setting, to let the child play out the tantrum, finish it?
You've described exactly the same thing. So you watch a child switch down to croc brain. You cannot negotiate with a lizard or a crocodile. There is no arguing with it. There's no negotiating with it. It's reptilian. So leave it alone. Now, leaving it in the living room may not be great because the child may pick up something and smash it. The child may hurt someone. So you may need to ask them to go to their room or go outside. So I wouldn't necessarily let them play out the tantrum, say, in aisle 7 of the local supermarket. You may need to, you know, pick the child up and go put them in the car or something. But don't try and negotiate. Don't try and reason. Let the child calm down. This information is absolutely life and death useful for people in the military and in the police force when they're negotiating a hostage situation. They know this better than anybody. You've got to talk a person up out of croc brain so that you can reason with them. You've got to understand, they need to understand they're safe, they're okay, and they work. They spend 10, 20, 30 minutes bringing the person out of threat response into, okay, you're a human again. You know, you're a person again. This is great advice for parents. You know,
so is this, why, This one also works with your partner. If your partner is experiencing an intense emotion, fear, even anger, maybe not the tantrum, just an extreme fear, and is crying and is physically breaking down, that means your body's collapsed.
Yes.
Is that why it's so effective to simply say to that person, whether you hug them or not, depending on what your relationship is, to simply keep repeating to that person, it's okay, you're okay, everything will be okay. Because what you're really saying to that person is, you're safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You're safe. And it, physical touch is one of the most powerful ways to do this. You've got to be careful, again, depending on the relationship. But even a hand on a shoulder, a reassuring touch on the hand will kind of reset them, or can reset the thing, and just say, listen, it's all right. We don't have to talk about this, you know, right now. We're going to work this out. It isn't a catastrophe. And then, you know, they can calm down.
So, Robert, that's the neurological explanation for something that I began many years ago in Houston, Texas. I was teaching at a Unity church, and I was teaching Sunday school. And in that class, that group of almost 20 or 30 children, many of them came from single parents. And I noticed that the boys who didn't have a close relationship with their mother would be the unruliest. They'd be the ones who wanted to get more attention from me. Instinctively, if that's the appropriate word, I would keep talking as I'm teaching, and I would walk around the room, weaving in between everyone, sometimes it was a circle, and I would put my hand on the shoulder of the boy that I know is either being unruly or has been or will be, and I would just keep talking, and somehow he would immediately calm down. And if it wasn't
immediate,
very close to me. Now, you're saying the reason that was is because of the neurological difference. See, I always perceived it as being an emotional reinforcement, an emotional validation, but you're saying it's not. It's actually neurological.
Well, no, it is. So let's not confuse things. There are three layers to the brain. So the lowest layer is physical, biological. The next layer is emotional, the limbic system, and the layer above that is cognitive or thinking brain. What you're doing is you're employing a emotional and tactile response. You're touching the person, so they're experiencing reassurance biologically, and you're speaking to them kind words, and the touch is also an emotional attachment response, and so their limbic system is also being calmed and soothed, and you're bringing them up into their cognitive brain. You're bringing them up into their human mind where they can start being reasonable. So don't leave out the emotional component. That's really important.
Robert, this has been unbelievably enlightening. Could you kindly summarize the second half, the points that we didn't summarize the first time?
Okay, so to understand that neurologically men and women are going to respond to emotional and environmental threats differently. So the female brain is wired, hardwired, softwired if you like, to think about the threat and consider what their role should be. The male brain is going to switch immediately to croc brain and respond to the threat directly. This has implications for our relationships because he's going to jump up and deal with the response and she's going to say, what just happened? There are implications for car accidents and when people act as witnesses, key witnesses in court cases. This has implications for parenting and relationships. So we then in the second half talked about the three layers of the brain, croc brain being the lowest and most physiological, monkey brain being kind of the social or emotional brain, and then the upper brain. A man is going to view a woman in an argument, he's going to view her as a threat, and as it escalates may get physical. She is going to view him as somebody that she needs to understand, and her emotions are going to be, you know, flooding her system, and she's not going to be able to, you know, she's going to express those emotions. So this is how fights often go down. The take home for us, I think, today, Patrick, is you can't negotiate with a crocodile, so you're going to need to deploy some strategies to bring your partner or your child up out of that condition. And physical touch is one of the most powerful ways to do that.
Yes, let her have his storm and let the child safely complete his tantrum.
That's right. Tantrum.
All right, Robert, this is not only has it been a pleasure, but it sincerely has been more than enlightening. I myself am going to listen back to this a second and third time because there's so much to learn and so much not just to learn but to memorize and accordingly apply in life to gain a greater understanding about oneself and about the other people with whom you interact.
Yeah.
Just in closing, please share your website and how people can use your services to improve and better their lives and their relationships.
Great, thank you. The first thing is I want to direct people out to Luann Brizendine, and they can just type in Men's Brains, Women's Brains and look for her TED Talk. She recently did a TED Talk on all of this, and she would be the lead researcher in this field. If you sort of listen to this broadcast and say, I don't know if that's true, yeah, go and have a look at her. Our website is www.fraserholmes.com, so that's FrazerHolmes.com, and you'll see on there we do all manner of coaching, but my favorite is relationship coaching here, and we've been talking about that, so have a look for me. I do a podcast on iTunes, and I write for, you know, a wide range of magazines on these topics, so you'll be able to find those things. I do coaching with people all over the world. I have clients everywhere, and I just love the fact that the internet helps us, as we've done, Patrick, today, to connect, you know, via phone, via Skype and the internet. So it doesn't really matter where you are. Look me up, and if you think I can be of service, I'd love to hear from you.
It's funny because I was going to ask if you have clients around the world, and I'm glad to hear that you do, because I'm sure that there's lots of people will be able to benefit from your expertise, your knowledge, and your approach is unique. It adds extraordinary insight into the way that, into relationships, and I've been teaching this for a long time. If you want to influence and persuade people, if you want more success in whatever your relationship is, be it romantic, business, social, familial, the key is to understand the other person. Always seek to understand the other person. And you've really helped us to do that today. Thank you very much. Again, the website is Fraser Holmes, FrazerHolmes.com. Robert Holmes, it's been a sincere and extraordinary pleasure. Thank you very much for sharing your wisdom and your expertise that you've amassed over years and years of working with clients and obviously years and years of research. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure, and thanks for having me on, Patrick.